Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
It's Current State for Tuesday. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We all continue to process the revulsion to yesterday's marathon bombing in Boston. We express our condolences to the families of those killed and fighting for their lives and injured. Apparently, no one from mid-Michigan appears to have been among the casualties. I was struck this morning by the comments of one longtime marathoner from Kalamazoo who finished yesterday. Sarah Yetter, 37 years old, quoted in an MLive story this morning as saying she doubts she'll do another big city marathon. And there are plenty of big city marathons. The most renowned of them all, of course, are all, you know, it's London, New York, Chicago. And what especially spooks her now, according to the MLive story, is the fact that a third undetonated bomb was discovered near where her husband had been sitting, which is chilling. She calls it the saddest day ever for running. Condolences all around. Coming up later on in the program, we talk with poet Carl Phillips, and once again, it is legal to fish the Red Cedar River on the campus of Michigan State University. The last time you could do that, oh my, John F. Kennedy was president, I think. But at the top of the show, late yesterday, the Lansing City Council continued discussions about one of the most challenging parts of next fiscal year's budget, spending for city police services. Mayor Virge Bernero's proposed spending plan for fiscal 2014 includes a $700,000 cut to the police budget. And there's pressure from elsewhere to cut even more. About a month ago, the administration's financial health team recommended $1 million less for police. And here to review that and other business before the city is at-large City Councilwoman Kathy Dunbar. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much.
Before we get to the budget, tell us about the beefed-up security for Sunday's land. It's so ironic this should happen in Boston just days before our second Lansing Marathon, but I understand security has been beefed up for Sunday.
It is. I am actually on the planning committee for that, and obviously we all watched in horror as events unfolded yesterday. I do stress that it is. We don't know who did it. We don't know why they did it, but it's probably very, very specific to Boston being a large, visible marathon if it wasn't targeted at something specific to that race. So the likelihood of anything like that occurring in Lansing is slim to none. That said, we have, for all major events here in town, contingency plans, emergency plans. We have a command center set up downtown. We have operations in place, emergency medical personnel along the course. The city of Lansing has an emergency manager, Mike Hamill, who has been working with the crews on the planning for this for days. Long before what happened yesterday, but as an added precaution, we will be having bomb dogs out sniffing at the finish line of all of the different races. There are several components to the marathon. There's a marathon, a half marathon, a 5K, a children's race. But again, I stress, and we have all stressed that are on the committee, the likelihood of this happening in Lansing is slim to none.
Do you know anybody who ran in the race yesterday?
Our race director, Owen Anderson, was out there with someone who ran. They were not near the incident that occurred.
Okay.
So they're fine. And luckily, I was happy to read the same report you did, that nobody from mid-Michigan was injured yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on to the police budget situation here. I'm led to believe the union, the police union, and the administration had some kind of session yesterday, But after last night's council meeting, do you know where the process is exactly?
Well, I'll address a couple of the things that you said in the beginning. The budget as you saw it earlier today, you mentioned that it's a little higher than it was last year. We've had to deal with a deficit, which is a projected increase in costs over the next fiscal year, which runs from July of this year to June of 14, and a restriction, obviously, in the income that we have. So that's where the deficit comes from. I just want to make that clear, because a lot of times people think that it's a spending deficit in the current fiscal year. So we project that we have to cut a certain amount from the proposed budget next year to equal the amount of money that we have coming in. That being said, the budget for police is actually higher than it was last year.
It is. And for fire.
A lot of that has to do with the fact that we have increased costs with health care, increased pension costs. The cost of doing business as normal in the city, just to maintain services as they are, goes up every year.
But where does the $700,000 figure come from?
The $700,000 figure is the savings that we achieve, and that's included in this. Let me explain. The increase that you see in the police budget includes the $700. $700,000 would be on top of that if we did not get some kind of negotiated concession on the health care issue. So whatever you see, right now you see $35 million. You can add another $700 to that if we don't get the concessions. That's what the mayor proposed. That's what he was hoping for by the time we budget.
Okay.
So the budget is balanced according to what was presented to us, but it takes into account they would like to have this negotiation take place with $700,000. The reason, and this is how it came up last night, every other one of our bargaining units, our administrative personnel, they have gone in line with the hard cap proposed by Snyder. So every municipality around the state has had to deal with this 20% cap on contributions to health care. And so the police were exempted from that. And so what the mayor is asking in this budget is that the police come in line with that, like all other employees.
And so when we're talking about a $700,000 cut to the police budget, we're focusing on long-term health care?
Yes, and okay. It's not a cut to the budget per se. It is budgeted in this fiscal budget.
And it's getting police officers to pay more for their health care.
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yes.
Okay.
We asked last night if it had anything to do with a change in the quality of the health care, the amount of benefits that were available, and it seemed that the police department and the finance department were focusing on the fact that it is bringing them in line with the co-pays and the deductibles that all other units are paying.
So there is no... To what extent are they sacrificing anything if they agree to pay higher health care?
They would be paying higher health care.
They would be paying. But how big a sacrifice is that?
Well, we're asking right now what the current health care situation looks like and how much more the co-pays would be. Right now, what I believe I heard last night is there are obviously co-pays for normal visits, but there would be a percentage and a deductible that would be instituted for anything beyond that, which again is in line with what other departments are doing right now. The difference with the police department is that their contract does not open again until 2015.
Right.
So they are the ones that are in place with current health care until then if they choose not to open.
But the fact that discussions are already taking place, does that mean the union is open to opening the contract before it expires?
I don't know that is the case. My hope is that they're willing to negotiate it, because obviously one of the things I made clear last night, I wanted to know if there is no concession reached, if there is no compromise reached on the health care, the $700,000 that we anticipated in savings that's already in this budget, where would that come from?
Right.
Would it come from another department? Would it come from another line item? And I was told by finance that it will come from within the police department. So we need to figure out where is the movement there. There's not much right. left to cut. As far as fat, does that translate into officers on the road? I would hope not, but that's something that's up for negotiation between the union and the administration.
Are you supporting the mayor's plan to charge residents for streetlights and fire hydrants?
You know, it's a very good idea. I will say that I am supportive, and I've done my research on this one. It was quite interesting when it was first proposed. We all thought, oh, it's gonna cost people too much money. It spreads the burden out for the deficit over the entire population of all users of electric and water. And the math on it is quite nominal. When you look at there's about 60,000 electrical customers in the city, about 40,000 water customers. You're looking at a 2.5% proposal to tack on a fee to cover streetlights on the electric, and an 8% proposal on water. There are 20,000 streetlights in the city. They cost about $200 on average to operate in a year for the lights and the maintenance of the poles. That's where the $4 million comes from. There are over 3,000 fire hydrants in the city, which we all benefit from in the case of emergency. They cost about $474 a year to maintain and for water flow and what have you on average. That's where the $1.5 million comes from for the hydrants. So those are legitimate costs. They're not made up. When we talk about spreading them out over the population at 2.5%, I brought you my electric bill. I've brought you my bill. So I'm going to tell you that in the Dunbar household, my total bill is $71 a month. I'm conservative with my water, and I'm conservative with my electric, but that's not an unheard of bill. My electric portion is $42. 2.5% of $42 is about a dollar. So that's what I would add in a month to my bill for the electric. My water bill is about 14, 8% of that is also about a dollar. So I'm looking at $2.16 on my bill every month for 12 months, which is $25.92. That's what my portion would be for streetlights and fire hydrants.
So an equitable way to come up with $5
million. $5.5 million.
$5.5 million. Okay.
To spread it out over the entire population. And when you think about that, $5.5 million represents 55 jobs.
An article in the most recent City Pulse suggests that the new charge is a tax, not a fee, and that legally speaking, a tax, any tax, needs to be approved by a popular vote. Are you concerned about that?
It's not a tax. There are rulings on this. Right now, as it stands, there are there's probably 12 different municipalities and townships that are within the Board of Water and Light Service area. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6 of them are already using the method for spreading the cost for fire hydrants over their population.
Right.
So it's already being done in other locations. There are plenty of municipalities that do the streetlight charge. Right now, the city pays for that out of the general fund, and we are alleviating that and putting it back into the Board of Water and Light.
One of the legal eagles quoted in the City Pulse article said, quote, one of the findings of a lawsuit from the late 90s, I think, that involved the city of Lansing, Bolt versus City of Lansing, a fee must serve a regulatory, not a revenue-raising purpose.
It's not a revenue-raising purpose, though. We're just transferring the cost of the fee off of the general fund. It's a fee that would normally need to be paid. We're not doing it to raise money. It's a fee that we already pay.
Okay.
We're just transferring it over back to the Board of Water and Light.
I wish we had more time.
That's okay.
Appreciate your coming in here this morning. Kathy Dunbar is a councilwoman on the Lansing City Council. I hope the negotiations over the budget continue to go smoothly.
I do too.
Thanks. In December, the MSU Board of Trustees lifted a 1960s ordinance which banned fishing on campus. Students are now allowed to fish the Red Cedar in designated areas. And to promote fishing on the river, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources released 3,000 fish into the river yesterday. Some MSU students and staff hope welcoming anglers will help improve the river's reputation. However, as current state's Emmanuel Berry found, before you can get students to fish on the river, you may have to convince them that there are even fish in it.
The Red Cedar River on MSU's campus has a bad reputation.
I wouldn't go swimming in it.
I saw, like, ducks in the river. I don't know how they got there.
I call it the cedar nasty. That's just like a thing that I do. It's really gross.
Those are just general impressions of MSU students Katie Barnes, Brady Ryan, and Sophony Philidor. When I mention that MSU students are now allowed to fish on the Red Cedar, I literally have to convince Sophony, the student who's dubbed the river the cedar nasty, that there are fish in it.
No, there are fish in there. Fish live in the river, right? Exactly.
Plenty of fish.
Well, I personally have caught over 20 species of fish from the Red Cedar, ranging from steelhead and salmon, both coho and Chinook salmon.
John Hesse is an adjunct professor in the Fisheries and Wildlife Department at MSU. In the past, he worked for the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Public Health. For years, John has worked with students on river cleanup projects on the Red Cedar. He said the perception that many students have of the river is not all that accurate.
When you look at the aquatic life under the surface of the river, you find organisms that are related to high-quality water. Studies have shown, actually, that the water quality index on the Red Cedar on campus is really high to extremely high because of the presence of these indicator organisms.
John came to Michigan State in 1965 to do graduate work in the Fisheries and Wildlife Program.
Shortly after I came here as a graduate student, I was fishing over by Beale Gardens, and I hooked a large carp and was bringing it in, and I landed it, and there happened to be a reporter from the state news right up on a bicycle just at that time, and she had me hold up this big carp, and sure enough, that ended up on the front page of the state news the next day. I've been kidded a lot about it over the years, but no one thought about it being me doing something wrong by fishing on campus. I had no idea that there was an ordinance against it.
The ordinance John is referring to was put in place in the 1960s because MSU is considered a preserve, therefore no fishing allowed. That changed this December. The MSU Board of Trustees voted to allow anglers on campus in designated areas for a 3-year trial period. John said the decision could help shake the river's bad reputation, something he's been trying to do for years.
There's always been a negative image of the river as being badly polluted, and people get interested in a river based on how good the fishing is. And I think if they see people catching good quality fish, they're going to respect the river that much more because it is a productive urban fishery.
An urban fishery freshly stocked with 3,000 steelhead this Monday, courtesy of the Michigan Department of Natural Resources.
We're planting 3,000 trout in the Red Cedar River so that they'll spend a little bit of time here. They'll go out to Lake Michigan. They'll come back, and it'll provide the opportunities for fish or for students to fish for a world-class fish.
That's DNR Director Keith Cray. Cray, along with MSU students and staff, tossed buckets filled with jumpy steelhead into the river.
I'm wondering. They're lively.
Once all the buckets were tossed, the remaining fish were blasted into the water from a pipe attached to the fish stocking truck. Imagine a giant fire hose filled with fish. Anxious students were already waiting to cast out their lines. Fisheries and Wildlife Master's student Jared Ross decided to try and fish, even though he's never had much luck on the Red Cedar.
I've typically not caught a whole lot. Smallmouth, but people do catch salmon and steelhead in here.
Regardless of his fishing success, he said he's glad the ordinance has been lifted.
I think it's a good thing to at least get the perception of the river in a little better light because people think it's a crappy river and it's dirty when really it's not. I mean, there's definitely worse rivers in the state, so.
As for today's haul, Jared's first catch is a nice, big branch.
Look at that, I'm about to catch a tree.
Master angler.
From the banks of the Red Cedar. For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
Is Elder Grant. It's a book about America a long, long time ago. It has so many awesome parts. You simply won't believe how much this book can change your life. Hello, my name is Elder Green.
The Wharton Center for Performing Arts announced its 2013-14 season last night. WKAR's Peter Wharf chats with Wharton Center Executive Director Mike Brand about some of this season's highlights, including the smash Broadway hit, The Book of Mormon.
Well, we could start with The Book of Mormon, since that's one of the biggest hit Broadway shows of this decade. And that's going to be on our Broadway season next season, the MSU Federal Credit Union season. And it's actually going to be at the end of the season in June 2014.
Is it common to see shows that are so successful and of such notoriety hit the road so early on?
Well, I think over the last few years, producers of hit shows like Wicked, Lion King, and now The Book of Mormon are pretty much experienced in how to produce and cross the North American continent. So Book of Mormon, all during its first big hit year in New York, its first season, looked at a strategy that was very conservative, not with real big eyes, but with a view of maximizing ticket sales by doing shorter runs in every city. So they put together a production which is now running in New York for a number of years at a complete sellout, of course. And there's a sit-down production in Chicago, and we're part of the first national touring company, which will be here. It's opened up this in the middle of this year and is doing some of the bigger cities. And we're in the route here in the first year that it's touring cities, you know, maybe two, possibly three cities each month.
Mamma Mia is a fun and popular show that comes to the Broadway series. Talk about that and a couple of the others that are coming to your Broadway series in 13-14.
Well, Mamma Mia comes back to most major performing arts centers every 4 or 5 years, and so this is our interval to bring that back. Beauty and the Beast was also a huge hit here in East Lansing. It was part of the first national touring company, I believe, in the late 1990s, and it's the first time it's coming back since then. So we are very excited to see that great Disney production back here.
Can we get into some of the classical headlines? I was thrilled as a string player to see that Yo-Yo Ma will be returning to the Wharton Center.
Right. He's one of these artists that doesn't really do a lot of solo touring. He does do appearances with major orchestras around the world. And his Silk Road project is it tours a little bit, I think, every year, every other year. But we were lucky enough to get on his agenda for his solo recital tour. And so he'll be on the season next year, as well as two orchestras that don't do a lot of U.S. national touring. The St. Petersburg Philharmonic does New York appearances in Los Angeles, I think, on a very regular basis, but it doesn't kind of get all the connecting cities in between. So we're part of that tour.
it is thrilling to see the St. Petersburg Philharmonic. It's really one of those Eastern European orchestras of virtuoso players. Rachel York is coming. Tell me about her and what we can expect to hear in November.
Well, our audiences here in Central Michigan have seen Rachel in a number of Broadway productions that we've presented here. Last year, she was here as our guest for our donor concert, announcing our season. Then she turned around and starred in Anything Goes, which opened our season that we're just finishing this year. She's a resident artist that year, so part of her time is on the stage and part of her time is going to be in the MSU Federal Credit Union Institute for Arts and Creativity. So she's doing education activity here in a recital in the Payson Theater, and then she'll be on our series at the Traverse City Opera House when she's finished here at the Wharton Center.
More classical music at the Wharton Center includes a Christmas tradition that you see on concert series across the country. They haven't been here in a little over a decade, though. Happy to see the Vienna Boys Choir returning for Christmas in Vienna in December.
That's right. We are on their Christmas tour this year. They come to the United States doing regular repertoire during, you know, most parts of the year, depending on how it fits into their schedule in Europe. This year, they also added a late November and most of December Christmas tour, which we were able to fit in on their tour. So we're very happy to have them back at the Wharton Center. They were here a number of times over our 32 years, and I think it's been an absence of about 10 or 12 years since they've been here doing this this Christmas in Vienna performance.
Talking with Mike Brand, Executive Director of the Wharton Center for Performing Arts here at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Mike, the season opens with Diana Krall and continues with the Newport Jazz Festival in terms of jazz performances and beyond. Can you talk about jazz at the Wharton Center?
Well, Diana Krall is going to be our season opener, and of course she's got this new hit album out and a huge world tour, which we are a part of. And the tour and the album are the Ragdoll World Tour, Glad Ragdoll World Tour. And so we're very excited to be on her agenda opening in late September. The Newport Jazz Festival 60 Now Tour celebrates their 60th anniversary of the Newport Jazz Festival. And it's got a very stunning lineup, as well as we have the young French artist Cyril Ami here with her band, doing a Michigan tour here in the west side of the state and up in Traverse City. So it's a nice, diverse lineup of artists for the jazz series this year.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me.
A classic and a Tony Award-winning play coming to a theater at Wharton with Shakespeare and more.
That's right. We have the acting company doing something a little different that we're kind of following what a lot of resident theaters around the country do. And we're going to have them come here on a Saturday in February. February 15th, they're going to do two different plays the same day, a 3 o'clock and an 8 o'clock production. The afternoon production is William Shakespeare's Hamlet, and then Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And in between, audience members have a chance to buy a box lunch here served in the Chrisman Lounge and kind of have a day at theater at the Wharton Center.
Mike Brand is executive director of the Wharton Center for Performing Arts at Michigan State University here in East Lansing. Mike, thanks for a look at the 2013-14 season.
Thank you, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Wolf.
Today on Current State, we have a special live public poetry announcement. The world-renowned poet Carl Phillips will be on MSU's campus tomorrow to give a talk and a reading as part of the month-long celebration of poetry at the Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. Carl Phillips is about as decorated a poet as they come. Among his accolades, two of his poetry collections have been finalists for the National Book Award, and he served as a chancellor for the Academy of American Poets from 2006 to 2012. Carl's also a professor of English and African and Afro-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis, where he joins us by phone. Hello, Carl Phillips.
Good morning.
Good morning. Before your poetry career really took off, you were a high school Latin teacher, and you managed to rise to become a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. That is quite a progression. Can you take us through how that happened?
It's a little dizzying. I guess I just was writing poems, and somewhere along the line, a poet was visiting the high school and saw some of my poems, suggested I try to get some of them published, and I don't know, suddenly I was going to the writing program at Boston University, and then my first book won a contest, and I ended up with this job here in St. Louis. It's supposed to be a visiting 3-year job, and now it's been 20 years.
Oh, my. Well, it sounds dizzying, but it sounds really gratifying.
It is. I'm grateful every day for it, actually. It's very exciting to do something that I love, and apparently it's my job.
Was it a surprise to you to find that your work had such an audience?
Yes, I think of poetry, mine at least, as being very private, and so there's something exciting but strange when it seems to resonate with a larger audience.
Well, that intimacy is a big part of your work too, both physical and emotional. Mm-hmm. Why is the body such a focus in your poetry?
I think maybe because, you know, we all have them, obviously, and I think that it's difficult to be in a body, you know, and I'm interested in how we're told we should behave, but then how our bodies seem to want us to behave, which sometimes the two come in conflict. So, and I think that's something many people can relate to.
Well, we've got this brain that tells us all kinds of things, and we've got this body that mm-hmm. that has a hard time processing a lot of what the brain keeps telling us to do. Is that a part of it as well?
That is, and then the trouble that can lead to, and the moral quandary about it. So I find it fascinating.
Your work does contain a lot of questions. Is this a process of discovery for you, writing poetry?
Yes, I think of writing a poem as a kind of wrestling with unresolvable issues, and yet there's this desire to try to resolve, you know, big issues like love, desire, sorrow, loss.
What sort of things motivate you to commit to writing a poem? Do public events, does the tragedy that just happened yesterday in Boston, is something like that apt to inspire you to write?
It isn't immediately, but the situation in Boston, which is where I'm from originally, is something that at least makes me start thinking about the randomness of violence and the ways in which innocence can be struck down. And that will sometimes generate a poem which won't end up having a bomb or a marathon in it, but it will be something that has come off of my thinking about that event.
Have you spent much time in Boylston Street and Copley Square?
A lot of time, in fact, right at the finish line area many times. And there used to be a bookstore there that I frequented, and so it's very strange this morning to see in the paper the picture of the street, the site, and
The Boston Public Library jumped out at me. We were out there for 8 years, and to see the library building right across from where the where the bombing took place. How do you know when a poem is finished? Are you apt to revisit it with a mind toward tinkering with it again? And when do you know when it's done?
It'll sound a little mysterious. I just know. I just have a sense that it's shut itself down, and that's very exciting. That doesn't mean there's not revision then in terms of line breaks or tinkering with words, but I feel as if I've come to the end of something. I tell my students that you know in the way that you know when you're in love.
Okay. There's just a completeness to it. Is that close to it?
Yes, and a feeling that something is finished, not the issue itself maybe that you were wrestling with, but at least there's been a temporary closing off of something.
In an interview, you said, quote, "Poetry is a reflection of the sensibility of a particular mind." And from what I've read, it seems like you may have to remove yourself from the world, maybe, to enter into that particular mind. Are you creatively fed by things like writing retreats or readings or teaching?
Not the first two, not writing retreats or... what was the second one?
Readings.
readings. No, I am more often fed by silence, privacy in the natural world, and strangely enough, certain routines, walking my dog, things like that, that, I don't know, seem to enable the mind to go on its own direction for a while, and that's where I'll stumble into an idea. But I do find that teaching is stimulating. There's something about being exposed to different ideas and trying to present them to students, and that gets me thinking for my own work.
So there is a there's a dimension of solitude in it, and there is a dimension of community in it as well.
Yes, and I think the real community part happens later when you find yourself sharing the poems, and with luck, someone relates to them in some way.
Well, you've agreed quite graciously to recite one of your poems here for us this morning. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear here.
It's the title poem of my new book. It's called Silver Chest, and I like to think of it as sort of a belated love poem, let's say.
Silver Chest, a belated love poem.
Sure.
Okay.
Silver Chest. Unafraid is what we were, I think, and then afraid. Though it mostly seemed otherwise. I opened my eyes, I saw, I closed, I shut them. The usual morning glories twist up through banks of gone wild by now holly. Crickets for song, morphos for their glamour, which is quiet, blue and quiet. You, the dark that nothing, not even the light, displaces. You, who have been the single leaf that won't stop tossing, among the others, for you. The end.
That was very beautiful. Thank you very much for reciting that.
Sure, thank you.
Poet Carl Phillips will be on the MSU campus tomorrow. He'll be giving a talk at 3 p.m. at Snyder Hall, room C201, and tomorrow night at 7 p.m. he'll be reading selections of his work in the ARCA Theater, which is also in Snyder Hall. Carl Phillips, a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for joining us today, and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Current State, we'll discuss the first ever Michigan State University Science Fair. Also, we'll speak with activist Roy Bourgeois and Katie Doyle. That and more Wednesday here on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry as well. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.